Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamau Murray.
Welcome to the Tennis.com podcast. I'm your host, Kamau Murray, and we are here with one of the coolest guys on tour, Rob Steckley. A guy, when I first was on tour, I found somebody that dressed like me, talked like me, as uptight, didn't have the traditional Wilson or Prince clothes, kind of had on some Air Jordan stuff and a little bit of mainstream clothing on tour. Rob Steckley, welcome to the show.
What's up? Thanks for having me. Come on.
So I remember when you and I first met, it was kind of like, oh, okay. You know, when I first started on tour, you know, you get 50% of the people that are standoffish. Yeah. 25% of the people who are trying to figure out how you got here compared to how they got here.
Yeah.
And then 25% is like, oh man, what's up? You know what I mean? We're all kind of like in this life together, stuck in Europe or stuck in Japan. Right. Let's like keep each other company. And I put you in the last category, man. So
yeah, me too. Me too. Yeah. Right away. We caught good energy.
Yeah.
So
man.
It's funny. It's funny because when I first entered tour, I was just trying to figure, you know, what percentage of people I'd actually have like a good relationship with and you can connect with off and on the court and ultimately try to organize the best practices possible for your players so you can actually feel like you want to be there as opposed to, you know, let's dip as soon as possible.
Right. That's like, oh man, how much more time we got? Right. You know what I mean? Like, exactly. You know what I mean? And that's interesting because a lot of it is the environment. You know what I mean? And, you know, putting your player not only with somebody that they will have a good practice with.
Yeah, of course.
So somebody where they were like, oh, why'd you put me with this chick? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And from a coaching standpoint, it was like finding people who, hey, let's have a good practice. What do you guys want to do? What do we want to do? We need to do this. What do you need to do?
Yeah.
And it's not super awkward and standoffish as we cross the net. You know what I mean?
Like, of course.
It's like
did you ever have to get in conversation with your players, you know, kind of bouncing the idea of would you want to practice with this player or was it, you know, just you're going to practice with, the player? Because I know myself, I actually would ask a lot of the time because I knew, you know, maybe this player might be a good hit, but not the best, you know, friendship out on the court. So it's going to be more about work. Can we work through that awkwardness a little bit and cross paths and not talk, but still make it productive, you know? So did you ever find yourself in that boat where you were actually asking, do you want to do the hit or?
Typically, I always would give them like two options. I would say, hey, we need to practice. We're probably going to play at one, right? So first on or whatever. Here are the two people that are looking at one.
Yeah.
Which of the two would you prefer?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I would try to take that approach, right? Or if we like lasted long in the previous week, we get there and we're kind of late getting our feet on the ground, seeing who's around, seeing who's looking. Then it'd be like, yo, you either practice with me or you practice with her. And my player is always like, I'll practice with her. Right? You know what I mean? Or early on, we practice with somebody and we walk up the court and, you know, the player would be like, don't ever practice with her. Don't ever put me with her again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, I got that lot.
And it's sort of interesting where it's like you could see them kind of talking off the court, but then we actually practice with the player and they get like super competitive. Yeah. Or we're warming up and the player's like hitting the crap out the ball. I remember like Rebecca Peterson, somebody where it's like, you know, super nice girl, but like literally 3 minutes into the warm-up, she's cracking it. You know what I mean?
It's kind of
like, easy time. Let's like work our way into this. Let's get a rhythm kind of thing. Yeah. And you just ripping forehands, right? And you start, you look at your player, you're like, oh, it's going to be.
Oh, yeah. You know what type of practice is going to be, eh?
Yeah, like the player's like, I hope you warmed up in the gym, baby, because first ball, I'm cracking it. You know what I mean? So I definitely would like get the player's input first. What about you? I mean, Lucy, you know, you spend a lot of time with Lucy Zaparova. She, to me, personally, like just demeanor wise, she seems so easy.
And oh so my God.
Pleasant. Did you have that? Does she still have those practice quirks?
Yeah, of course. But you know, going into those practices, you can give her, you know, you would lay out some options, right? But sometimes those, you know, the better practice would be the more awkward one. And we'd have a discussion thinking like, you know, this is the best scenario probably possible. Can we manage to mentally get through that and just work on a couple little things and have it more competitive? And there won't be so many high fives, but are you up for that? And almost every single time, she'd always say, yeah, for sure. As long as it was the best case scenario, you know, meaning time-wise, time slots and get in, get out, that type of thing. And even if it was somebody that she didn't really prefer to practice with, she would always understand that it was best for her tennis and ultimately, you know, running through the event, trying to go deep. So we never had any issues, but there was a few times where she's like, oh no, you put me on the court with that, you're going home.
Right. Now, I mean, Lucy's a lefty, right? And I think that for me, if I'm you, I'm like, damn, you know, how many people try to avoid playing a practice match with a lefty because their opponent?
Yeah, well, you know what? I didn't find too many issues with that just because Lucy, like you said, was just like a stand-up personality. Like nobody disliked her. Everybody liked her. There was just something about her. Also, she was an incredible athlete and tennis player. So being a lefty, obviously, maybe for the warm-up, there might have been something, but you typically, there was never any issues. Even when I was with Dennis, like everybody wants to practice with Dennis. It doesn't matter whether he's a lefty, you know, and it's the day before, everybody would just crank some balls with him. So it was just, it was pretty easy. I didn't have that scenario where I might be working with a player that players also dislike. They don't really want to, you know, be out on the court with, maybe not the greatest hit. And then in addition, they're in a lefty, category. So it's like right. Three strikes, you're out.
Right. So for our listeners, Rob is the former coach of Lucy Safarova and Denis Shapovalov. But before we get that, I want to know how you ventured into pro coaching. You know what I mean? I think we all grow up, we play juniors, we play college, for the Federation. We play one or two tournaments, you know, and then our dreams get crushed and we're like, yeah, I don't have the goods to make it on tour. And we end up coaching. Tell me about sort of your tennis journey and how you got into it.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny. In a nutshell, I'll start even earlier. It was like, you know, you have this pretty good, solid foundation through juniors. You think you're going to go pro. You know, funds aren't there, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Go the college route. I was immature thinking like, you know, I'm too good for this. Did fairly well the first year.
Now, where'd you go to school?
I went to school in South Carolina, Gamecocks.
Gamecocks, yep.
Yeah, Gamecocks. And then after the first year, I quit tennis, quit life in general, bro. And like, I literally went down, you know, the spiral of just like hitting rock bottom for 2 years. I just avoided, I guess, reality. And I just was running from all the torment and headache that tennis kind of created in my head. And ultimately it was just ego. Right. And then I found myself picking myself back up in my early 20s and then got an opportunity through somebody saying, hey, would you want to go back to playing college ball? And I had figured out, you know, working for $9 an hour wasn't the route and thinking I had it so good prior to that. Mm-hmm. So I ultimately just, you know, had this aha moment and then went back into school and just hustled. And even down to even my schooling, which I was terrified of, I worked my ass off and just grinded on and off the court, and then found myself with an opportunity to go play Davis Cup. And so I had gone and, you know, played Davis Cup. I played for a couple of years out on tour. And then ultimately I figured out, it's probably not the best option continuously forking out money. I could barely pay, you know, for my flights and making enough money to pay for some coaching and, you know, all these factors. Just, I hit that moment where I was just thinking, you know what? I think the smartest thing for me is transitioning into coaching, because I actually found myself in the last year helping a lot of my friends out there, even when we were playing doubles and going to watch friends' matches. I was actually, I just had that knack for enjoying, you know, to help others. That was something that I found was crucial for coaching. But at that time, I didn't realize what it was. I just thought I was just that guy, you know, like I just wanted to hang around the courts and help other people and whatnot. And then, and so I slowly transitioned out of that plane and into coaching. And then I had to find my lane. Obviously, you know how that goes. After you stop playing, it's like, do you go private sector, high performance, you go national program, like, I don't know, or tour, you know, that was still foreign. Like I didn't even think tour at that time. So I just started naturally with our national team in Tennis Canada. And then it quickly just, I got an opportunity to go to tour with Alex Wozniak, one of our Canadians. Mm-hmm. And that was it. It was like, hey, Kate, you probably would understand it. It's like you've been grinding your whole life and you still have this passion for the sport, but you never really made it. I mean, you're in and out of that circle, you know? Yeah. And I saw a lot of my friends, they ended up making it. And so I got that opportunity. And all of a sudden, practices were now not on court 18 in the middle of nowhere. Right. They're in a center, in a stadium, you know, and there's people watching. And I'm like, this is the life that I never had. And I'm like, this is my life. And that was it. That was it. I never looked back from that point on. I just stayed out on tour. And, you know, I networked and I just really enjoyed being out there touring and competing. And I found my true calling was helping, but also being out on tour. So yeah, now, just that's
now, just so I'm clear. So you started at you know, South Carolina. When you went back the second time, did you have the opportunity to go back to South Carolina?
No. Yeah, good question. I went to, because I got, I guess what it was called, academic probation. I had all of these, you know, terms where you're just not eligible. I even put pro because I was like, you know, I played a couple tournaments right after and I'm like, I'm going to collect the full check of $32, you know? And I'm like, yo, that was the bad mistake, because afterwards it was impossible to go to D1 and it was almost impossible to go to D2. But this coach named Joe Cabri I went to Lander University, which was a Division II, but they were number one in Division II. He took a chance. He said, full ride, you come. I'm going to make sure that your ass gets a full ride and you get to play. And towards the very end of the first year, I still wasn't eligible. And we had been writing to NCAA and trying to, you know, work out how we're going to get eligible. And somehow he figured out some loopholes. And sure enough, just before I was set to go home, and he had even said, this is the type of guy he was. He said, I'm going to have you come back next year. And I'm going to find ways to make sure that I make up for your academic scholarship. And we'll find ways so you can sit and continue your schooling. But as long as you can be here, I want that for you. And he came to practice with the papers literally like 2 weeks before I was supposed to go home. And we were kind of just sad because it's like we tried so hard. I was training. I was in the right set of, like, the right mindset. And I just wanted to give back to him and because he'd done so much for me. And sure enough, he actually got me eligible. And then I won everything the next year, literally. NCAA, like Division II, like the national, everything, national titles. Like, I just was like, here. That's how much I appreciated the opportunity and what you did for me.
Mm. So, okay, that's clarified for me. So at what point did you meet Lucy, right? Because you get out there, you're out there with Alex Wozniak. Then you meet, I mean, Astud, like, because what I think or what I see from Czech players is they very rarely work with a coach that's not Czech. I mean, yeah. Like, I can't even, like, name, other than Lucy, I cannot name another Czech player that works with the coach that's not Czech. And it's like one of the things we talk about, right? So yeah. How did you connect with Lucy?
Well, I mean, that's a crazy story because I'll tell you, I mean, you're asking some good questions nobody's ever asked, you know, like that little, how did you meet? You know, it wasn't that easy. It was, you know, with Wozniak, do you see these like little things that pop up or are you going to be?
No, I don't see any of that.
Okay. Yeah, I got her to play doubles a little bit with Alex Wozniak, because Alex was very, very sweet girl, but she was, you know, in her shell. She didn't want to socialize. And I thought it was critical to actually make a few friends out on tour. And we came across doing a practice with Lucy, who was the most shy girl I'd ever met in my life. And she was dating Thomas Burditch. So she just, like, that was her little circle, just Thomas and the tennis court. And that was it. And when we spent some time out on the tennis court, she was the sweetest girl. And I told Alex, I said, we should try to play doubles with this girl, you know? And she's like the nicest person. You guys could totally be friends. And I would love that. And, you know, just build your circle out a little bit. So it was, wasn't just so, you know, just intense. It was just tennis and hotel and just, you know, the crazy thoughts out of losing. Yeah. It's just add a little bit to your, you know, your team and just, and socialize a little bit. Right. And of course, you know, Wozniak was 20 years old, 21, somewhere there. Right. So she needed to learn how to have friends. So we became friends. I stayed in touch a little bit. And then when she had come to Toronto through the years, I'd been working with different players. I was with Mirza and Adina Galovic. You know Adina?
Yeah.
You would know Adina, yeah. And so I'd been coaching these girls, but sometimes I'd have off weeks and Lucy would come through. And it just so happened that at Rogers Cup every year, I wasn't working. And so Lucy and I stayed in touch and she just asked, hey, do you want to help me? But not coach. It was very clear. Like, right. And so just, you know, like help, not coach. And I was like, absolutely. So, you know, I did the practices with her and just formed a relationship with her. And ultimately the following year, I forget which year it was, the year before we actually started, she asked me again, but this time she said, would you mind actually coaching me this week? And I was absolutely, you kidding me? I would love to. And so she ended up making the semis that week. And she ended up making the quarters the year before and lost to Serena. And then she lost, she had match points and she was up 5-love against Lena in Montreal in the semis. But that she bought into, you know, I think the respect realm of like where I was coming from. And she got out of what typical Czech people would see from guys like us is like, you dress different, y'all talk different, everything's a little bit different. But if you spend time out on court, the tennis IQ and everything is really respectable. Yeah. And then they're like, wow, we did not expect that at all. So that's what I got from Lucy. And then from that result there, when she had given me the coach title for the week, that was it. She said, I absolutely love working with you. I trust you 100%. And she was working with another coach at the time. And she just said, you know, as the months go on, let me figure it out. And then I got the call and that was it.
So, you know, what's interesting about our sport is that you look at people, you look at like now you see teams, right? I think like Serena was like the first person to like have like a team, you know what I mean? Where like it wasn't really clear on what people did, but they were just around, right? And you know, like now we still see some players, like when they first start now, they got like one person, right? They're going forward for one person to travel. Then you see a little bit of money come and then you get like one more person. Yeah. You're not really clear what they do. They're like, they can hit, but they're not the hitter, right? But they can play, but they're not the coach, but they always talk to the coach. And you see one more person show up and he's like clearly the physio, he's massaging. Then you see one more person come up and they just around creating this sort of atmosphere, right? So I always find it very interesting. It's like, yo, can you help me out this week? And it's really not help because help is free. Service is not. So you're kind of like helping, but not steering the ship. But like you bring something to this environment for this week. Mm-hmm. Even if it's you're helping keep the coach coming. I remember like Sloan used to joke all the time. Like, you know, what does such and such do? They'd be like, oh, so, okay, Kamau's a coach and such is this. He just keeps Kamau company. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, you know, it's kind of like, you know, like whatever it is, it's working.
Absolutely.
You know
absolutely.
What I mean?
I mean, building out the team, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, even down to boyfriends, I mean, as a coach, honest to God, those are things that we think about. Like if it brings value or if it doesn't, you know, and if it does, in which way, or is the player looking or missing something And can we bring something, add something to the team? Even if it's just some random person that makes the team atmosphere that much more light, they're bringing complete value at that stage of that person's career, right?
It's not, because it's so, like sometimes you get tired of staring at the same person. Like, okay, I'm tired of going to dinner with just this person.
Oh.
The conversation's stale. He's getting on my nerves because we just got off the practice court. We need to add somebody in, even if it's somebody that we're just going to make fun of, right? And tell jokes about, right? You know, we need to like change the energy and add a third person.
That's funny. I so see that being Sloan.
Yeah. So we're both like saying, right? So that the coach is saying and clear-minded to help me this week. The player is saying, maybe it's a girl, then go in a room and keep each other company. You know what I mean? Like maybe it's, so I saw when you said like the player proactively says, can you help me out this week? But not coach. That's the player saying, I don't know what I need. Just be there. Pick up balls. Don't be in the way. If you notice something, find a way to like casually mention it.
Yeah. Well, and so to that point, I'm going to piggyback off of that because I knew my place, but if you're in that realm of like working your way up into that circle, you know, you got to know the hustle. And like, for me, it was like, that was a really big opportunity into that next stage of player where I really felt I wanted to be, but not overstepping at all. So, hey, I'm just here. You asked me to be here. I'm going to be as light as possible, but pepper in and just sprinkle in some feedback and, you know, and clap at the right time and just do whatever I think could help, but not get in the way at all. And then leave them with that thought of, wow, I mean, I got the result and he didn't overstep his boundaries, but he was really there for support. And you know, he gave a lot more than what I was expecting. And so I think that's, if anybody's listening who has an opportunity like that, they have to kind of treat it like that, because I hear a lot of people that come to me still and, you know, and they're trying to work their way through like a hitting partner scenario and work their way up. And they're like, I'm, you know, I'm giving her all this feedback and coaching and I'm not getting the credit. You know, it's like, it's not about that. It's, you know, you got to earn that, you know, that title to them and whatever that means. So you might be going around, you know, thinking with your ego and you want something that, you know, it's not going to be given and you shouldn't want that title. You should just be there and be okay with whatever it is. And if it happens, it happens. So, you know, I think that's what we're talking about here.
When were you with Lucy? Cause you know, I look at her and I look at like 2015 French Open. Right. And that was a slam that got away from her, right? And I always say, like, man, it's just, they don't do that often, right? To get to that point. And honestly, to play Serena on clay is probably the most winnable surface.
Yeah.
You know, where someone has the best chance to do it. Were you around at that point? When did you come on board?
Yeah, I was there for 2 years prior. So we had the first year was questioning where can we make improvements. Do you want to just go the confidence route, or do we possibly make some changes and add growth to your game long term? You know, and so we had those conversations. So that was the first year. Then, you know, it didn't even happen right away. She was like, you know, and we're still testing the waters, but we had these conversations. Then I think it was like 3-4 months later, she just out of nowhere stopped at this truck stop. We got like these Wiener Schnitzels in Austria. And she was like, I want to do it. I fully trust you. I want to commit to change. And I'm like, excuse me, out of nowhere. And we sat there and just had a conversation. And then we got into it. And I'm like, okay, like you 100% want to actually make some change. So that was that first year of transition and making the change, putting in just hours after hours. And it was just so much fun in that point of my career. And then the second year was where the results started to pay off. But as a coach, in your eye, you can see like micro wins, like just out on the court, just, you know, like she might've lost, but like she was actually taking the down the line, but with more authority and better footwork and like, it may be not the right time, but like it was much better than 3 months before. So you could see as soon as that starts cleaning up and, and certain things, you know, and we keep building, that could pay off. I still didn't know at the time, you know? Mm-hmm. And then we keep working, and all of a sudden, boom, she wins the tournament Quebec after US Open.
Yeah.
And like, dude, I went on autopilot almost for like 3 months. I didn't say anything. She just started winning. And because all of the work from the first year translated into the second year, and you basically, my job was to fine tune things, but it wasn't to put heavy workloads and say, okay, we got to do more now. And we got to, it was just transitioning, you know, what we had cleaned up and added, and now maybe adding and starting to add, you know, the mid-court game and now some volleys. So now we added doubles. And so that was that year. And then she made semis at Wimbledon. And that was the big, like, whoa, something majors that she really achieved. And then that following year was Serena, which was exactly like you said, the match that got away. Like, I'll never forget. Okay. She was up a break, dude, in the third set, bro. She was up a break in the third set, and Serena, and she had a break point and Serena's second serve. And I was sitting there like this, watching that serve, and that return comes in, but she'd been committing the entire time. She got herself through that second set and just on fuego, and then got up that break. She was up, like I said, two love, had that sitter return, dude. And you know, when Serena's like, she didn't want to hit it, like, oh, like this, it was sitting, and Lucy shied off, and it just went the shallow open court ball, like in the middle, you know. And Serena also woofed another one, and Lucy just spit it back up, and then Serena cranked a forehand inside out and did one of her magical, you know, like roars, but like, yeah. That was the one where it was, you know, I'd seen that from scouting her so many times where I'm like, oh my God.
Right. You can just see it, right? You can feel it. We had our shot. Ah. And what's funny is I always, like, when you think about like, you know, at that level, right? Slams. You not only remember being up a break, you not only remember the score, but you also remember first serve or second serve. And like, yeah, you think about like when you have, yeah, I always think about 2018 French Open, where it was like up a set, up a break, second serve, high to the backhand, and just like, it's almost like that was like your one chance to sort of pull away. And when you didn't take it, then you like, the other player just sees you didn't take it. And then they say, okay, I'm going to take it back now. You know, and I think with Serena, I remember that match. I was like, oh yeah, that was the one. Like, that was your one opportunity to show her that you weren't afraid to take it. Mm-hmm. And then she starts screaming and yelling, and then it's like, okay, now it's over, right?
She was unstoppable from that point. And it also was the point where Lucy had turned around after she had lost that game. And she rather than being upset, she gave me this look of, we're here, you know? And I'm like, oh, we're not, my match isn't done, dude. And I think I even went a little bit too much, you know, like I was way too in it. At that moment where I was just like, no, don't give up at all. Like, you got to put your foot down now. But it was just that moment, you know, and Serena just became a beast and literally started ripping shots, and Lucy was being yanked around, and it was still a good quality third set, but she just had that edge, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned like things that you could have did better. Like you as a coach, you're always, especially on the women's tour, as a coach, you have more opportunity as a coach to impact the match in the match. Your reaction.
Yeah, that's what I love. That's what
you think you went too hard. And I think when I look back at like 2018 French Open, I think I was too calm. I think I was like, and I'm not even this kind of person, right? When I look back, I'm like, damn, I should have like got up, walked out the stadium, made a scene or something to like change the energy when we felt it slipping. And you're always like, okay, what do I do to send a message? What do I do to change the energy? How can I'm not playing, right? We're not on court coaching in a slam, but I had to do something, but I don't want, you know, it's like, you always look back and say, damn, I should have did this. You know what I mean? And it's, how was Lucy after that match, right? Because to be in a slam where you're up a break and a game point, I mean, I'm saying it because I've been there, right? How did she, or how long did it take her to recover?
Yeah, I mean, she was disappointed. We were disappointed. But, you know, it's a tough scenario to be extremely disappointed overall, because, you know, you're playing the finals of French against Serena. So I think for me, I went through conversations for a while as to exactly what you just mentioned, like, what could I have done different to maybe change the narrative? You know, I was just constantly running that scenario over. Should it have started earlier? Should I have said different things, you know, and tried to plant the seed earlier, you know? Or even before the match, I could have said, you know, because we had known, because she had played Serena several times, but we knew, like, she has these moments where she just disappears mentally and right. gives you these gaps, but she always somehow gets back out on track. But when you get that gap,
you gotta go.
You gotta hold her throat. Like, that's it. You gotta go. And so I didn't, before the match, had that conversation, and you know, those are those things. But for her, you know, she was disappointed, but she was also, you know, we did it kind of thing, you know, as a team. And I couldn't hate on that at all. You know, like, I was just, like, so blessed to be a part of not only that result, but it was bigger than that. Working, you know, when, you know, I'm sure you understand, like, working with that one player that usually coaches always kind of want to get, like, she just was a perfect human being. And so seeing her disappointment, I was there for comfort. I couldn't get mad at that. And then we just, you know, we just enjoyed the moment and got back to work type thing, rather than being upset, because I had had conversations with her before, after close matches like that, where we were disappointed and we got into these heated kind of battles, because, you know, there are things that you should have been doing and you, right. and you didn't, but that wasn't the moment, I felt, you know, like,
mm-hmm. yeah,
you.
Yeah. No, I think after that, you got to pick them up. You know what I mean? You pick them up. Deep down, you're pissed, right? You're pissed at yourself. You're pissed at, like, oh man, we had an opportunity. It was on your racket, that kind of thing. But I think in that moment, you pick them up and you sort of put your pride aside. And then, you know, you do some self-reflection. Like, you know, if we get here again, what can we do so that when we get here again, if it comes, right? And sometimes it doesn't come. And that's the hard part, right? So you look at Lucy, though, and you look at, like, she's 5-0 in Grand Slam doubles finals. Right. Yeah. With Bethany Maddock, who I know well, and Justin, you know, great people. How was that? You know what I mean? Because it's interesting, because I think the doubles final doesn't get as much airtime, number one. Although most recreational tennis players, most tennis fans play more dubs than singles.
Yeah.
It's not as, you know, like, whatever, treated as favorable, but it's hard. Right.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it should be more. How are those doubles sort of championships, or, you know, Grand Slam championships, compared to the final, compared to the singles final you won in?
Listen, I'll be fully transparent. Like, I was never into doubles. You know, right. Doubles was a tool to transition a better singles. Like, that's my mindset. It's always been like that. It's still to this day. And you know, Bethany, Justin, we were great friends. And again, the conversation, I think, and that's where we were talking about, you know, those transition years, like the first year, second year, and what can we improve in Lucy's game? And it was very clear, she needs to play doubles with somebody that is going to lead by example, mm-hmm. and very strong at understanding how to play the net and whatnot. So when we went into that partnership, it was basically just for that mindset of, like, basically Bethany is going to help piggyback off of what I'm trying to educate you on and coach you. But mm-hmm. as a player, she's going to show you firsthand out on court. Mm-hmm. And that was the mindset. And bro, like, next thing you know, they're lifting the French Open trophy the first time they had ever played. Oh no, this was Australia. Australia.
They played Australia. Yeah.
And like, I'm sitting there and I didn't even expect that. So it was like, we didn't expect that. There was no, like, okay, so you guys are going to poach every third game. You know, like, there was no tactics, really. It was just, like, having fun and getting out there and really just working on things that she needed to do. And so after that moment when she had won, I didn't even think anything. I literally walked out of that stadium as if it was just a practice. And then it was afterwards when people are like, oh, Coach Steckley finally won a Grand Slam. I'm like, what? I wasn't even. And that's when it kind of sunk in, like, oh, I'm not, no disrespect, but like, I was like, oh, how double is this? I don't know. And it just turned into this thing where, it had this energy about it. Like doubles was, you know, respectable. And there, it was much more than just the task at hand when, and trying to fine tune the singles. And so we got into it afterwards, you know, it was a lot more about the doubles, but nothing measures. Like it's hard to equate like playing a singles final in a slam or even a semis. Like the work you put in is way more stressful in terms of like the build up, the lead on and off court prior to that event, then getting into the event, singles, one-on-one. Like, so when you get to that moment where it's a semis, finals, there's a lot more weight there, you know? So you're really in the moment. That's, you know, it's pretty special. And not to take away from the doubles at all, but I definitely feel, you know, there's something about being in that singles as opposed to a doubles, if that makes sense. You know, yeah, there's just a lot more that goes into the singles lifestyle and then we make it, you know, it's just like, wow, that's packed stadium. And just, yeah, it's a real battle out there. The doubles is unbelievable. I love it. And I became a person that really thrived. I loved getting ready for the doubles, you know, but the tournament didn't start, in my opinion, to the quarters, no matter what. Like I'd always say to the players, like, until you make the quarters, it's not really a tournament.
I know, right? Do you remember the 2017 Toronto quarter?
The Toronto quarter?
2017 Toronto quarterfinals, Lucy and Sloan.
Man, why? No?
No?
No.
You don't remember that? You don't remember when Sloan played Lucy, quarterfinal 2017 Toronto.
I don't know why I'm blanking.
And the reason why I remember it is because played you guys 2017 Montreal quarterfinal.
Yeah. Yeah.
7-5 and third.
Yes. I remember that. Yes.
The draw comes out Cincinnati and we got to play you guys again.
Yeah.
And it was like, we almost pulled out of Cincy because it was like Kvitova, Zafarova, Putin. I mean, it's like a bunch of lefties in a row. Oh, Makarova. It was like the same draw 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah, that's always tough.
You know, was like, damn, we're going to pull out a cinch. Like, damn, can we beat all those same players again? I'm like, yeah, we could do it. You know, it was like to beat Kvitova twice, Zafarova twice. It was like, we could do it. Like, let's not pull out. Let's play, right? It was like, and I remember it because that was the summer leading up to the U.S. Open.
We were
coming back trying to get some rhythm. Like, no, we're winning. We got rhythm. Let's keep going. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But I remember it was so odd because it was just three rounds of lefties in both turns.
Yeah. And so from a coach's perspective, you know, when you're playing, you know, three lefties like that, how did you feel, you know, like this is going to be a task, or were you starting to get used to, you know, game plans? Like it was already kind of set, you know, you kind of already, you know, been in the mud with those lefties. And so you kind of get their patterns a little bit more. And, you know, so you're like, I'd rather actually play three lefties in a row rather than, oh my God, because I know Sloan, like some players just can't stand playing lefties, you know, but some players Sloan's got an incredible backhand that, you know, when it slides there, she's ready for that back and she goes sharp cross down the line, like if she's trusting, you know, so.
So what was funny is, you know, during pre that summer, right, you know, she was injured, right? And we worked a lot on backhand line.
Yeah.
I mean, literally like months of just rope, open stance backhand. And so her forehand is big. Like she's famous for a big forehand.
Of course.
The backhand is solid.
You know,
back in the solid, and I think like this, from what we had been working on, it was almost perfect. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't want to say I was excited about it. I was like, okay, no, we can stand in there with a Kvitova forehand, right? We can stand in there with a Lucy sort of forehand because we can just burn them up the line with the backhand. Like, don't get caught in a cross court rally. Let's just use what we're working on. We worked on backhand line a lot, open stands, right? Reversing the ball kind of thing. Let's just do that, right? And I think that the fact that we had an opportunity, because it's weird, right? When you are like injured for 8 months and you're like sitting there with the same coach every day doing the same dumb drills, right? You're like, is this actually going to work? You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
And then you play, you start in the tournament, you're like, okay, it's kind of working. And you start to sort of build belief that what you have been doing in a vacuum for 8 months is kind of working. So I actually think that the series of lefties and hitting, so, I mean, she was like, I've never hit so many backhands in 2 weeks of my life. You know what I mean? And like, if you think about that, I think that helped build confidence together where you become so wide open, like, okay, whatever you tell me, I'm gonna do.
So let me ask you this, because it's interesting. When I hear that, were you at a point in your career where you knew exactly like, no, this is going to pay off? Or were you still on the fence? Like, I think this is where we could take things that make sense, but until it paid off, or had you already gone down that route before where you'd done that much work on a specific, when you guys were out and you already knew, you know, like, that was it. This is the plan. This is what's going to work for sure.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think about it this way. It's long got a big forehand, right? So when people stay away from your forehand and they start trying to go to your backhand, the best way to get the ball back to your forehand is to take that ball down the line to their forehand.
Right. That's right.
And then they start getting more forehands crossed. So really I did it. And really when you think about pro tennis, you don't really have a lot of time to improve. You know, you go to Madrid. The next week is Rome. The next week is Strasbourg. The next week is French Open. You got the same thing, Miami. You know, I mean, you got Indian Wells, Miami, Charleston. You don't really have stretches where you can like actually try to improve and add things. Cause you're like, okay, we can practice and like reset our mindset so we don't let this loss this week affect the next week. But that time was probably like the first time we had like 9 months where there was like no pressure to win tomorrow and we could just improve. So in my mind, I was thinking, the girl got a great forehand. I'm not gonna mess with that. How do we set, you know, construct the point where we can hit more forehands, right?
Yeah.
People are staying away from it. Let's get, so that was actually really intentional to like be able to like, you know, because normally you don't take a big forehand, a big backhand cross line. You take it back cross court. So let's work on irresponsibly going line. How do we work on taking the ball line that is so big that you probably should have taken it cross court? But now we just worked on staying on the inside of the ball where we can actually control it line to get the ball back to our forehand and then we can take our forehand. So that was like very intentional.
Preach, and, baby, preach.
You know what I mean? So it was very intentional. And we just were fortunate to have 8 months to mess around with it. You know what I mean? So I remember that because you think about Lucy, who at that time was a Grand Slam finalist. Sloan was not. Right. Mm. And so it was like, oh man, this, I mean, we got to play this girl 2 weeks in a row. You know what I mean? Like, you know, even if you win 7-5 in the third, you in your mind are thinking, can I do it again the next week? Because I barely won last week, kind of thing. You know what I mean? So it was like a lot of that sort of doubt thing. So I remember Lucy because you obviously you remember those two tournaments leading up to the US Open. Right?
Yeah.
Life-changing kind of thing. So that's why I ask about, you know, how she recovered after the Grand Slam. And then now she was a Grand Slam doubles champion at this point, multiple times. So now this is somebody that knows how to play under pressure.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so that's why I always think about Lucy. She's game and Bethany's game. So tell me about how you transitioned from Lucy to Chapo. Because I think about, you know, number one, you're Canadian. And I think about if I look at countries over the last 5 to 7 years, there's two countries that stand out and like getting it right. One is Italy, right? With the men, I mean, Musetti, Sinner, and I mean, all these guys, right? America, I think we did a good job too. We got, you know, Tommy Paul, Francis, some Fritz, you know, America like in the past year and a half is like, okay, we got this class of boys right, right? But Italy got a class of boys that's right. And Canada in general had Chapo, Felix, Bianca, Layla, Jeannie, Ronich. Right. So you get your hands on Chapo, who was fiery, spunky, lefty again, right? Kind of got that edge and that swag. How did you all sort of get together?
You know what? I kind of came full circle because right after I stopped playing, I transitioned. I'd worked with Bob Brett. I don't know if you ever remember. He passed away a few years ago. The Australian. He worked with Cilic and you name it. He's worked with, you know, the best of the best. And he came into our federation and ran the Toronto facility. So I went with him. Dennis was, I don't know, let's say 10 years old, 11 years old, something like that. So I spent a little bit of time with him there. But I, you know, Dennis, funny enough, like when we started work, he's like, you remember when you were teaching me the tweener? And I'm like, nah, dude, like, not really. But I must have, because that sounds like me. But spent time with him, got to know. But I do remember spending time with him and his family and whatnot. And you know, through the years, as he was playing the juniors, and I was out with Lucy, I'd always spend time with him a little bit, just, you know, giving him a little pep talk. You know, when I'd see him at the slams, and just telling him, you know, like, if you really, you know, work your ass off and you really believe, because I'd seen you since you were, you know, 10 years old, and your thing was playing to the utmost extreme aggression. Like, it was just, you know, one-handed, fiery kid, emotional, crying when he'd miss, like, but there was a lot of good. So from my perspective, I love players like that, you know, who are just cranking the ball, and you can teach them how to play tennis afterwards. But it's not the polar opposite, where they're just pushing, right? I see him out on the road, and we just kind of kept a relationship like that. And then it was at Wimbledon when his coach got injured, and then they started having the conversation with me, like, you know, maybe you could fill in a little bit. Are you interested? And I was, like I said, I was with Lucy, and we were planning on playing one extra year, and we're going to kind of do the farewell tour, play a little bit of doubles and really enjoy, you know, relish in that environment as much as possible. But sure, they'd come back again and say, hey, listen, you know, we would really like to have a conversation with you about you coaching him and whatnot. And so just one thing led to another. And it was just one of those opportunities, you know, where I think all coaches, if you spend a lot of time on the WTA tour, you think about, like, oh, would I coach on the ATP tour, or do I just stay in my lane here? But I had started with guys prior, you know? And so I think you're very similar. And that's what I catch from your personality, is like, you could flip flop from guys to girls, no problem. You know? So for me, I was one of the boys, but I really enjoy what I can bring with the girls and the women. I love that environment, right? And that space. But if you get me out on a court with an ATP player, like I just morph into that guy, right? There's no transition. I just become that guy. I've always been that guy. So it was, you know, an opportunity where I talked to Lucy, and she was like, honestly, you got to go to this, you know, like, you really belong helping somebody like that at that level and see what you can do. So I just, it was her push that kind of led me into, you know, ultimately just saying, like, yeah, let's giddy up, let's go. And then I took the position there.
So I find it, because I look at that period, and it was kind of interesting, because, you know, he was coming on, but, you know, like, when you first get on tour, you got to, like, learn how to be on tour, right? You got to learn how to, like, control the emotion at certain parts of the match. Stay under control off the court so you don't do anything. You know what I mean? It's like,
I
know you're, like, young and you got a little money, but you can't really go out tonight. You know what I mean? We got to play tomorrow, right? Or, you know, you can't go out the day, even if you play on Tuesday, you can't go out on Sunday because it's going to catch up. Like, it just catches up to you later, right? How was it being raising a young player, right? Because Lucy... personality, very mature, but young. Like, I think about a young Francis, a young Chapo, and it's like, I got to, like, make sure I tame this young bull. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a lot of energy, and it's fascinating because I had always worked with, quote unquote, like, more seasoned types of players, except for Wozniak at the very beginning, who was 20, but you know, more or less through, you know, those later years, it was, you know, players who had already been out on tour. So the transition that I got Dennis at was, you know, he had spiked out of nowhere, made this incredible run in Montreal, beats Nadal. Now he's the hometown hero, all this momentum, but and a ton of energy and game, but realistically has no idea how to use it and harness it. So I think that's what the previous coach was really trying to drill in. And of course, when you shoot up, there's going to be a stall. You just can't keep going. Some players can. But in Dennis's case, he had, you know, all of these things to learn. You know, like, you're a young stud. What do? You know, on and off the court. So when I came in, my job was starting those, or continuing probably those conversations, but really leveling up and doubling down on his, you know, his personality, his mindset, constructing points. A lot of it was tactical, trying to understand how now to play when people start to figure you out. And so bringing that element of, now you have to think, you can't just go on autopilot and crush winner. I mean, dude, if you can, by all means, go ahead. But the level is too strong on the ATP. You just can't do that. People, even with, people have answers for your creative mindset, you know? Like, they know your patterns. It's all out there, heat seeking. And we, and because I was a big fan of using all of that tech. So we knew everybody had his patterns and what he was doing. And when he breaks down, they really know where he's going and thinking. So that was my job, to you know, level up on those conversations and get him to be aware. And then cleaning up footwork and also being aggressive, but also learning how to have plan B and introduce that into his game, you know? So adding better slice, because his slice was non-existent. And there were so many elements, you know? So I got him at that stage where I think now physically he's much stronger, and he's playing with all of those tools. But I think there's an element of, you know, where he still needs
to grow.
To grow, you know? Like, I think that's where he's struggling right now, is just, you know, people know how he plays and he's flashy, but they don't really care, do they? Yeah. You know, like,
a little bit more meat and potatoes. Like, in the middle of the points, I feel like, you know, he can improve in the middle of the point. You know, push him to move, he can kind of shot make, right? If you push him, he can shot make. If you hit some, you know, some, give him some crap, he'll make you pay. But like in the middle, where he needs to just be more steady and more tough, where he's missing it right now. So that's sort of interesting. And that's where the tour presses you, right? When you're the new guy, not as much data, not as much data point, not as much film, but the better you do, we're sitting in that, you know, we're sitting in the player lounge, waiting on our match, watching you, right? You know, you pump your fists, right? We're watching, right? And then when we see where you're good, we're going to make you play where you're not. And I think for the men's tour, it happens quick. You know, women, it takes them 2 years. Like, people still haven't figured out Swiatek. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know.
With the men's tour.
I know.
Oh, in 4 or 5 months, we got you.
Yeah, no, they got you for sure. And they'll expose that, no problem. Even on a bad day, they're able to expose. And that's what I actually really, really enjoyed about flipping back to working with men and Dennis, is just, it's all tennis. Like, you got to be on at practice. You got to be on, you know, during your matches. And it's way more tactical and physical, and really it becoming about tennis. So that was that fun part about going back to the men's, you know. It's just, it's, you know, it's war. And even the top guys, when they're playing bad, it's like, you still ain't going to run through them. Like, there's so much. So it's work. You have to go and do the work day after day, and you can only incrementally work your way up the rankings. Whereas the exciting part about working on the WTA is, if you have a good workhorse and you know, they got that potential, you have no idea. It could be that tournament that you just run right through.
Yeah.
Even if you're working on things, it just, if you're mentally somehow there, and you know, it aligns. You can actually go through because there's a lot more momentum shifts. But on the men's tour, you got far less of that. And there's a level, you know, when you get to the quarters, even though you think like, oh, it could go your way. You're not ready. You know, yeah, you're not going to get through that.
On the men's tour, it's like you can't win every week. As long as Djokovic is around, Federer was around, Nadal was around, yeah, you can't win this week. You can get to the quarters, but you're not going to win. Where on WTA, you could probably win. I mean, every week, you do actually have a chance to win.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can win. Like, there's 25 players that can win. 20.
I love that.
You know what I mean? Right? Where the men's tour is probably 4 that can win this week.
4.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's sort of mental.
And then there's always one, like every year there's somebody that shows face, you know, and it's just like, oh, he's coming, you know? And like, there's just that one little racehorse that's climbing. And then all of the other guys that are in that 20 to 30 range, you know, it's like their hopes are now getting smaller because there's just always people coming, you know, and it's just the level on you know, the men's side right now is just so strong. So, unless you do the work and you really believe, like, there's limits to where you can take your game.
Yeah. So, you know, you and I, you know, you spend years on the road, right? Let's say 8, 9, 10 years on the road, 38 weeks, right? And then you hit a point where now you got family, you got stuff to do. What are you up to now that excites you, right? Because it's all exciting. Like, being on the road is exciting, right? Every week is a new place, a new hotel, new restaurants, new challenge, new draw. And then, you know, still being at home, it's like new stuff to do in this sport. This sport changes. Yeah. Like, so what are you up to now?
Well, I mean, currently working with our transitioning Canadian pros, in whether they're going to college or I work more on the pro side of things. But staying home, I mean, I got 2 beautiful daughters, my wife, we bought a new property, and intentionally with the property, I really want to build a small high performance center, you know, and kind of take what we had been doing for over 10 years out on tour with your team and condense that into, you know, a high quality, not oversaturated, you know, high performance, I like to say facility, but it's not really a, you know, it's like, it's a country club meets high performance and, you know, really bringing my experience and quality control to something exciting where kids come. And if you want to be a leader, if you want to really, you know, go forth in this sport, as well as be a good human being, that's kind of where I want to bring things rather than work under the umbrella all the time of being subject at, you know, at a club and having, you know, being regulated and always having to think within the box. I like to think outside the box. So I don't really want to have limitations. So that's kind of the vision. And also, you know, I'm looking out here, 10 acres, rolling hills, horses. I mean, it's just like this environment that I want to bring to where there's this peace of mind. But when you come here and you train, you know, you go 100%, but it's much easier. Whereas I found, you know, through the years, there's a time and place, but I found, you know, time's ticking when I'm in these environments and these clubs where it's like you're trying to get the work done, but it just feels so stressful and I'm out of place. But I've gone to these facilities and just random places in Europe and stuff where you're just, you know, surrounded by nature and you just get a ton of work done. And I think that's what I found with Lucy. You know, we'd been training in the countryside and we're just getting 6-7 hours of work and it feels like nothing. So that's my project right now. That's my baby that I've been working on.
That's exciting. Well, man, let me tell you, it's always fun chatting with you. One of the most interesting people on tour. I appreciate you as a tennis coach, but also you as someone that was willing to sacrifice your life for someone else's career. And I think that's the part.
Yeah, likewise.
Coaching on tour, where it's like, yo, for 38 weeks, I'm like a coach, a servant, a brother, a father, a shoulder to cry on, and I'm gonna go get tampons, I'm gonna go get hair ties, I'm gonna go grab water, I'm gonna get the towel, I'm gonna pick up the ball.
Whatever's needed.
Whatever's needed, right? And I think it takes a very selfless person to do that. And a lot of time we don't make the money that we should have, or maybe don't get like the appreciation, but I appreciate you. I appreciate the sacrifice. And I want to, you know, I appreciate
you. Likewise. I was excited when Nitin hit me up and he said, you know, you'd want to chat. So of course, my guy, that's right. 100%. But catch up. I wonder a lot of the time when I'm back here and you're not traveling and touring, you know, and you see everybody day to day, you wonder where people have ventured. So I was really happy to hear you're doing well and you're doing your thing like that. And it seems like we're doing the same type of thing, you know?
Same thing, so, one foot in, one foot out, staying connected.
Yeah.
Good opportunity comes, you take it, but, you know, totally fine. Being at the crib and building this, you know what I mean?
I love you, buddy. That's it.
Man, I want to appreciate you. This has been the tennis.com podcast with former coach of Grand Slam finalist singles, Grand Slam, five-time Grand Slam doubles champion, Lucy Safarova, and coach and mentor to Denis Shapovalov in his early days. Rob, I appreciate you.
Hey, thanks, Kay. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, brother.